Broadcasting from the Investor Hour studios and all around the world, you're listening to the Stansberry Investor Hour. Tune in each Thursday on iTunes, Google Play, and everywhere you find podcasts for the latest episodes of the Stansberry Investor Hour. Sign up for the free show archive at investorhour.com. Here's your host, Dan Ferris.
Hello and welcome to the Stansberry Investor Hour. I'm your host, Dan Ferris. I'm also the editor of Extreme Value, published by Stansberry Research. Today, we will talk with hedge fund industry legend and just all-around contrarian original thinker, Hugh Hendry. I am so excited to have him on the show. I wish we could just do a two-hour show with nothing but Hugh. It's so cool having him here. This week in the mailbag, questions about life insurance cash and what gold will do in a crisis. And remember, the mailbag is a conversation, so talk to me, call me, leave me a message on our listener feedback line and hear your voice on the show. 800-381-2357. Call me up. In my opening rant this week, I just want to point out two quick things about the recent drop in Bitcoin. That and more right now on the Stansberry Investor Hour. So real quick, just a couple of things, and I'll do a quick quote of the week too. Bitcoin, of course, it peaked a while ago, weeks ago, at just around $65,000, just call it. And then it bottomed recently at around $30,000. So, you know, more than half, like a 54% drop. And a lot of that happened last week, like March 19th to 21st-ish. That was like a 40%+ drop in that brief three-day period. So, wow, what do we think about this? You know, two things. First of all, it's the stuff that didn't happen, right? Like no bank went under, the Fed didn't have to bail anybody out. There was maybe some over-levered speculators who got crushed, and the whole crypto space lost like a trillion of value. Right. And we're not hearing a million stories about the broken financial system and the end of the world. Now, of course, that's because Bitcoin is new and it's not, you know, as widely adopted. It's not as big as the regular financial system. Right. So I think that's part of a function, but I think it's also a function of the nature of Bitcoin itself. It was designed. It came out of the financial crisis, really. That's when it came on the scene. You know, somebody got really sick of the financial system and he or it or they, we don't know, they're anonymous, created Bitcoin and, you know, in 2009. So it kind of justified its existence, really, I guess is one way to put it. But we didn't see a big systemic collapse because Bitcoin and, you know, crypto had a horrible week and a horrible, you know, several weeks, really. You know, that's the one thing. The other thing that I can't help mentioning is that Ray Dalio, of all people, says he now owns, I saw one article said he owns 6 Bitcoin, which, as I speak to you, is probably worth a little less than $240,000. He's a billionaire, so that's like, you know, walking around money. It's nothing for him. But he owns it and he talks about it and he says, you know, the biggest challenge is its success. Now, what does that sound like to you? To me, that's the biggest challenge of like Microsoft is its success, right? The Department of Justice went after him, you know, years ago. And the biggest challenge of, you know, Facebook and Google and huge social media companies that are like, you know, the greatest businesses that have ever existed is their success. So these comments by Dalio and the fact that nothing blew up, I mean, except for like, there was an article in the South China Morning Post that said like 10 billion of liquidations, you know, some occurred last week, like 19th through the 21st in that big 40%+ part of that drop. And that's fine. It doesn't really, you know, it makes you wonder, like a lot of these people, we're using 100-to-1 leverage. You can do that in the crypto space. So if all these people were using 100-to-1 leverage, you know, where are the blowups and the disasters? Well, obviously somebody, you know, the counterparty on the other side was or the broker or the exchange or whatever the heck, you know, however the market is structured, I don't really know. Somebody was over collateralized or collateralized enough somewhere so that people using 100, and I even saw one thing, 125X, I think is available in Binance, leverage like didn't blow up the world. So somebody somewhere is collateralized enough to handle that, right? And just the speculators got wiped out. And if that's all that happens, you know, hey, who cares? They a good speculator wakes up the next day and they're right back at it. So I just wanted to point all that out. You know, we got Ray Dalio, like one of the most successful investors of the past several years, has Bitcoin in his pocket. You know, he's got Bitcoin and he's an advocate. And he should be, because as he points out, it's a success so far. And you know it's a success when it crashes 54% and everything's just fine. Okay? Let me do a quote of the week real quick. I couldn't resist telling you this. There's a blog called Fed Guy, an insider from the Fed who puts out a blog, fedguy.com. And he says, control of inflation is moving out of hands of the monetary authorities and into the hands of the fiscal authorities. Future inflation will largely be determined by the level of fiscal spending and taxation, which drains money out of the economy. The one thing the Fed can still do is protect the moneyness, in quotes, of treasuries. That means lower rates and more asset purchases forever, just like the ECB and the BOJ. There is no normalization. We are firmly in a new paradigm. That's the end of the quote. And we're going to talk with our guest, Hugh Hendry, today about inflation, because he has a really interesting idea about it. He says it's a social phenomenon. So I wanted to get that quote in there in your mind. And you know what some things I've said about inflation. So let's do it. Let's talk with Hugh Hendry about inflation and whatever else is on his mind. He's a great guy. You're going to love this. Let's do it right now. Every week I tell you I'm the editor of Extreme Value, published by Stansberry Research. But I don't usually say anything more than that. Well, to my dedicated listeners who are looking to find incredibly valuable long-term investments, I'll tell you right now, my Extreme Value newsletter is a monthly publication that focuses on buying safe, cheap stocks only when the price is right. And I'm not over-exaggerating. Extreme Value picks have earned one of the most impressive track records in the industry. Mike Barrett and I spend hundreds of hours each month poring over balance sheets and SEC filings to find stocks trading at huge discounts to their true worth, giving subscribers a large margin of safety on every pick. You can learn more about that or sign up for the newsletter at investorhourdan.com. So you can support the show and find some of the most profitable ways to invest all at once. investorhourdan.com. Check it out. Today's guest is Hugh Hendry. Hugh Hendry is an award-winning hedge fund manager, a market commentator, a real estate investor, podcaster, and perhaps coolest of all, a surfer. Hugh founded Eclectica Asset Management in 2005 after working at O'Day Asset Management and achieved a 31.2% positive return during the 2008 financial crisis. In 2010, Hugh was named the most high-profile Scot in the controversial hedge fund sector and was even featured on Financial News' list of the 100 most remarkable people in European capital markets. And he's an all-around great raconteur, I can say. Hugh, welcome to the show.
Dan, there's so many half-truths in that statement, but thank you very much for having a renegade like me.
Yeah, you know, I dig the whole renegade thing about you, Hugh. With some people, it comes off obnoxious, but with you, it's endearing almost. I mean, I want to hear you, you know, say something crazy like, you know, inflation is a social phenomenon or something. It's just so different from what I hear from anybody else.
Hey, Dan, inflation is a social phenomenon. It truly is. We'll get to that. But I often thought, it was my thought bubble this morning in the shower. I put, you know, I am just, I'm new to Twitter in the last 12 months, and it is making my it is enriching my life. And I put something out last night. You know, just I just everyone's been talking about Elon's discovery about the energy intensity of Bitcoin mining. And I thought to myself, hey, what is the energy intensity of Visa MasterCard? Because it's enormous. It's out there. And, you know, you ask a friend on Google and boom, you've got a bar chart, and then you push it out into the decentralized intellectual community. And then, I mean, obviously you get bombarded with, you know, vile comments, but when you sift through it, you know, you educate yourself. It's magnificent. But to my point in the shower, I always thought that hedge funds kind of lacked or downplayed the role of a kind of John the Baptist, of a kind of crazy guy, the shaman, who kind of went about it a different way, pursued curiosity and an unorthodox, you know, kind of demeanor, and just sometimes that crazy guy was the one that could just get a glimpse around the corner of time, and that's certainly my modus operandi.
That sounds really cool. You should write. That sounds like the beginning of the foreword for a book or something. Are you you're working on a book, aren't you?
I am, yeah, with a ghostwriter. And your buddies send me, like, oh, yeah, so am I. And it's like, you know, macro investing, the principles. And I'm like, that's not my book.
No.
My book, we'll see. It's almost done. It's short. And, you know, it's that journalistic kind of lazy path from A to B. You know, the mistake that all investors make is that we're going to travel on a linear progression from point A to point B.
Oh, and
for me, I came from, if you will, the projects, like a really, really tough kind of poor and criminal and fearful sort of community in Glasgow in Scotland. And here I am today, and I'm in this billionaire island of St. Bart's, and feel 10 years younger. And like you say, I did my hot yoga this morning. I'll take some waves later on the board. I'm presently renting a little apartment in town because with my real estate ventures, you know, I own some of the most beautiful houses on the planet. And, you know, I'm a gypsy. I move out. I either live in the back of the Defender, or this week I'm in this little kind of nice little apartment by the harbor.
Really? You've lived out of the back of your car at St. Bart's? Is that what I heard?
Yeah. I think I was saying with Raul on Real Vision on Friday, the 1st of January, it was raining, and just, The cover on the back. I've got a 110. I mean, it's long. I mean, you can just. I mean, I don't do it that often. But you know, I like a bit of camping. I like to see the stars. I like to think. But boy, when it rains, you just go boop. You know, the drip on the nose. It is impossible. And that was one of the reasons why I ended up entering this year with 27 hours of consciousness, and then 10 days of COVID.
Oh man. So you're naturally immune now, I guess.
Oh, who knows? But you know, I'm fit, I'm lean, and I'm obsessed. You know, there are my members of my peer group are fiat currency billionaires, and I'm not. But I tell you, you can be a billionaire on in different metaverses, and in my metaverse, I am rocking it.
All right. Well, you sound like the right guy to have on the show. I can't get away from this idea of, you know, if it's too soon, let me know. But this idea of inflation as a social phenomenon, I mean, it's stuck in my. I heard you say that like last week on Real Vision, and I keep thinking of it. And you didn't really have a chance to get way into it, and I thought, man, I have got to find out what the hell he means by that. because, you know, everybody says the same. Everybody says, you know, inflation is a monetary phenomenon in all times and places, or whatever that quote from Milton Friedman is. Yeah. And a social phenomenon. I mean, like, how is inflation a social phenomenon? I don't get it.
Okay, well, first and foremost, to put the plug in, about this time last year, so I closed my hedge, I kind of lost the last kind of paying client at the end of 27, would you believe, in the same week that Hurricane Irma struck the Caribbean and, you know, and the coast of America. And it closed down my residential properties for about 9 months. So, boom, you know. But, and then I kind of, you know, I had so much of my identity wrapped up there. And, you know, did I fail? You know, closure is a strange thing. You know, what happens after closure? Is it binary? And I probably went into a kind of, I went into my own personal confinement. And as is the way with my life, you know, I found myself kind of at odds and with a different cadence to the rest of society. And so, of course, about this time, about 14, 15 months ago, when the world was kind of going into their own enforced enclosure, I was kind of coming out. And I've been very fortunate, again, that St. Bart's had been one of the, you know, just one of those kind of little bubbles where life has kind of prevailed. Long intro to say that I launched many efforts on social media. I think you mentioned that in the intro. I'm out there with Hugh Hendry Official on YouTube doing podcasts. I've got a neglected but a nice jolly looking website, which is eponymous. It just has my name without the official. And if you go on there, I believe you can get access, or it will badger you. There'll be a pop-up saying, hey, get the Dawn of Chaos. And so I wrote a paper, and it's to this point of the social phenomenon of inflation. And so I would encourage you to read that. But of course, now I will attempt to preface it. And I'm not seeking to replace the Milton Friedman comment, because it's obviously it's true. But I think it supersedes the monetary phenomenon, changes in the mood of society. And that can be a very large macro description of society, or we can make it micro. And the micro consideration, the mood, which is most important and which I believe has been neglected in the whole quantitative easing debate, is the mood of risk takers, and more, again, narrowing again, the mood of bank lending officers. Because ultimately, money printing in a fractional reserve system, money printing is the reserve, is the domain of risk-seeking commercial bankers extending loans to pay for these liabilities that we call deposits. And being a bank is, and you know, I would love to set up a bank today, but that's another story. You know, when those who, that was a wonderful saying that goes back to a wonderful Canadian strategist, and I'm going to forget his name at the present time, but so what is he called? It's not Hickey, he's American. Anyway, the most golden, beautiful, bullish opportunities present themselves in those areas where those who know it best, the insiders, where those who know it best love it least. And that's banking today, and that's kind of like one of my kind of funky things, which, you know, would validate why I would love to set up a bank today. But banks don't like being banks today. Banks are fearful of the consequences of lending. And the central banks, in the context of America, the Federal Reserve, has been bombarding this little social community of commercial bankers with reserves, with free reserves. The Fed is, if you will, typically the role of the Fed. It's a bit like my role as a parent. I've got teenage kids. And and left to their own devices, they will smoke cigarettes, drink alcohol, and God knows what other kind of nefarious drug-like products. And if I'm not there, they'll have all of their buddies. I mean, I remember I was in St. Bart's and I got a call from a neighbor saying, you know, we have a five-story house, and just saying, look, you know, I fear for the kids because they're jumping from rooftop to rooftop. You know, so I'm the Fed, the kids are the banks, right? And there are times such as the period from, let's date it, from like 2003 to 2007, where the bankers are kind of like my crazy teenager, jumping from rooftop to rooftop, swigging bottles of whiskey, you know, smoking marijuana. And the Fed's kind of got to go, hey guys, calm down. You know, this is not one of those periods, you know, ever since the debacle of the financial crisis in 2008. And remember, let's just be bold. The US financial system pretty much became insolvent. You know, it was the 1930s 2.0. And we could be sitting here today with nominal GDP kind of 20% below those levels if central banks had pursued an orthodoxy of intellectual prejudice and a kind of hard money regime. Now, I say could because that's conjecture. I mean, it didn't happen. There's no, that I'm just judging it against the null hypothesis of what has happened. But anyway, so the Federal Reserve is kind of saying to these kids today, hey, listen, have one on me. Like, here's, what have they printed? What printed is this absurd term, but they have facilitated about $7 trillion of free reserves, just saying, which is essentially, you know, fags and booze. And it's just like, guys, look, I'm looking that way. I'm out of the country. Have fun. And the remarkable aspect is that such is the kind of curmudgeonly and fear-laden attitude of the bankers that they're like, you know what, I've still got a hangover. I still don't have an appetite to go crazy. That's the social mood that has yet to change. And quite remarkably, I mean, in the last 3 weeks, I think it was the CFO for JP Morgan was kind of saying unprecedented things, saying, hey, stop sending deposits. You know, they're phoning up their biggest clients saying, guys, we love you, but we're full. And for us, we just don't have the risk-taking capacity to extend credit to offset these liabilities you keep throwing at me. So, I believe the Fed has created a language and a conversation around quantitative easing, which is very much in keeping with a kind of Wizard of Oz. The mighty wizard is omnipotent and is out there and it's doing something, you know, J. Powell last year, and it's not unprecedented, but it happens rarely that Fed chairmen go on daytime TV. You know, and the notion is like the real folk watch daytime TV. And it's like, hey, you know, we're with you. We got your back. And we're doing something. We're printing. He actually said we're printing money. He actually kind of convoked this idea of a printing press. And it's baloney. But in a kind of social universe, he feels the need to impress upon the agents of society, hey, guys, I'm trying. But like the Wizard of Oz analogy, when you look behind the curtain and you examine the reality, you're like, hold on a second, what, really? That's all, that, this is the omnipotence? The omnipotence is putting $7 trillion of reserves that banks have no appetite to lend? Really? So clearly, you know, we had a profound drawdown in nominal GDP, and we had layoffs and unemployment, which surpassed, I'm going to use the benchmark of the 1973-74 economic recession, because when oil initially went from, what, $2 to $10, in terms of crunching GDP declines. That was enormous. And yet, you know, obviously last year just took it out. It was just far greater. And so we're, you know, and that was normally these things are brought about by dysfunctional behavior by risk takers, you know, bidding up house prices, bidding up technology prices, etc. And then when they fall over, getting into difficulty, or you know, bidding up the oil price and creating shortages. You know, last year we had an invasion of the body snatchers. We had an alien invasion of the human body, and we got this profound smash. But it's like a kind of ship, and it's righting itself. The problem that remains, and for all the, and you know, the financial press are a great area to watch social mood, and the financial press shouting, "Hey, inflation, inflation." It may come, but it's going to need a change in the social need, the social vector of the banking sector. And you can kind of chill out, just sit and watch, you know, large US banks and their expansion, their balance sheet expansion. Once it starts from, like, beginning to motor between 6, 9, 10%, hey, taper, raise rates. But nothing, there's nothing happening just now. So that is social mood. Think, you know, Volcker typifies the challenge of the social mood of the banking community. And it's best thought of as a poker game. Now, I kind of wear sunglasses, so you can't see my eyes, but I got so many body ticks that, like, when I'm unhappy, you're going to know about it, you know. So I'm the worst poker player, but so take me out of it. Think of a poker game where there's just two people at the table. One is the Fed chairman, and one is the JP Morgan, right? And back in 79, the banking community, it was kind of the opposite. They had a profound credit. You know, that we had this creation of euro dollars, you know, when the oil price went up, you know, the Bedouin Arabs and all of their cousins and neighbors had this influx of money. They put it on the account of both US banks domestically and offshore, creating the euro dollar market. Banks were flush with liabilities, and they lent. They lent to Brazil. They lent to, you know, the sovereigns of South America, thinking that was risk-free. That was erroneous. And they lent to corporate and household America. And a bank is like a hedge fund, and it only has two options. It can invest in US treasuries, bills, or it can invest in, you know, free enterprise corporations and the personal sector. And all of its time, it's just kind of trying to make decisions between the two. And what I'm saying just now is the banks are like, boom, fully. They're like, we want risk-less assets, okay? But back then, the banks were like, we want kind of risky assets. We want loans because we're fearful of inflation, and at least we feel we have inflation protected embedded in the smart loan contracts that we have with our clients. So then you have this new Fed chairman, checks and guy comes in, ka-ching, 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 and, you know, sits down at the table and is like, guys, I'm crazy, right? So you all know that I said to you, 73, 74 was a mean recession. And it was brought on by an oil cartel. And hey, look at the front page. They're doing it again. We've gone from 10 to 40 bucks. We know the story. You know, these risky assets that you have, they're going to have to endure an almighty recession. Are you sure? And the bank's like, no, I'm still sure. I'm still sure. Like, I can see the inflation. And Volcker's like, okay, well, like, tomorrow's Saturday. I'm going to raise rates by 100 basis points. That's how crazy I am. It's like, you're talking about, we're going into the mother of all recessions and you're going to raise rates. He's like, yeah. And then next month I'm going to do it again. And until you mothers change your dumbass attitude, I'm going to keep doing it. How brave do you feel now? And so, you know, this went on for 18 months. But Volcker changed the course of history because he changed the social mood of the bankers, and you know, not quickly, but you know, that the gravitational pull went from risky assets back into buying risk-free with yields of 15%. And he changed the course of history.
Right. The beatings continued until morale improved. But here's what I don't get. And I'm glad you went through all that. I have read the piece, but you know, I read things and I stop and I read. I probably haven't finished it because I read in all the wrong way. I start at the end, I go to the middle. It's, you know, it's a mess. But here's the thing. Maybe I'm making a mistake in differentiating QE, which, you know, as you point out, QE, you're swapping a dollar, you know, the Fed maybe prints that dollar, right? That's what Bernanke said. We mark up we go to the computer and we mark up the account. And then they switch that dollar, they take income producing assets out of the system and they leave this dollar reserve. And if it doesn't get lent and spent, who gives a crap, right? Like you're saying. But I'm differentiating that from what is traditionally called monetization, right? When the government says, okay, we are just going to spend and we're going to do it by borrowing a couple of trillion, and we've got programs because, oh, let's say, as you put it, the invasion of the body snatchers happened and we responded to it in a particular way, and it's, you know, it was worse than the Great Depression for 6 months or something. And so we're going to do the spending. We're going to, in other words, to me, that monetization event is like the government saying, okay, so the social mood isn't changing. We're going to step up and be the first in line, and we're going to go big or go home, and we ain't going home. That's what I'm seeing. That's how I look at it. Am I wrong to see it that way? Am I wrong to differentiate in that way?
A little bit, in that constitutionally, can I say constitution? I don't think I can. But the Federal Reserve Act updated for, I don't know, 1935. And here I'm just, full transparency. I am enrolled, and I would encourage others to be enrolled in the Eurodollar University put out there by Emil and Jeff Snyder. If you are a young Turk and you're harboring ambitions to work in a macro hedge fund, if you were to come to me and you could not quote chapter and verse from what Jeff puts out there on that thing every week on his YouTube channel, you know, I'd show you the door very quickly. What Jeff's forgotten about the Federal Reserve Act and the powers of the Federal Reserve, what he's forgotten in the lunchtime, yeah, I've still to gain over a lifetime of curiosity. And I'm quoting Jeff in that, you know, the Fed is not empowered to monetize the US government's debt, its deficit. You know, so you have to remember. And it kind of all sounds like semantics, but it's not. It's clearly not, because you know we don't as yet have inflation. More importantly, again in terms of social mood, whilst there are relative price increases, whilst there has been a movement in long-term bond yields, you know, long bond yields are still hovering around about 1.6-1.7%, even with, you know, your outline case for the government stepping in, you know, even for Stan Druckenmiller saying this is the most, you know, Larry Summers, this is the most irresponsible US government intervention, you know, we can ever think of. And yet 1.6, 1.7, you could extend that to five year forwards with inflation curves. And, you know, again, experts, the people whose social mood has to change, not changing, they're like, this is nothing. This is nothing. So, Federal Reserve quantitative easing and how it would interact with these larger and larger deficits. The Federal Reserve is issuing perpetual liabilities to purchase those bonds from the private sector, and so it is not technically, and I think in reality, there is no monetization going on. And where Jeff I think really nails it. Why all of these, you know, hey, Japan's public government debt to GDP in the last 25 years, I'm making this up, Dan, but I want to say it's gone from like 45% to 245% of GDP. And nominal GDP has been kind of, you know, Goldilocks, not too hot, certainly not too hot, and kind of verging on kind of a little bit too cold. And so what's missing? The thing that's missing again is the verve of the entrepreneur, of private sector commercial agents saying, my pecker is up. Forgive me if that's a misogynistic term. Yeah, but yeah, I bring it on. The ball was this size. I want to take risk. I'm looking for partners to take risk. And we're not seeing that. You know, I find myself on the other side of a quasi-religious, a religious debate about the 10-year yield getting to what it was, 43 basis points last year? Did it get there? And, you know, after the, at the height of the TMT bubble, Fed rates were like 5. Long rates would have been 5. So we've gone from over 20 years, we've gone 5 to kind of, let's call it 0. Was that because the Fed did QE? Or was that because of the economic climate? And I would say it's the latter. It's that social mood that there was a desire on the part of private commercial risk-seeking entities that they denied themselves risk-seeking opportunities. The reward wasn't sufficient. And all they lusted after risk, risk-free, risk-less securities. And that would extend itself from 10-year treasuries to Amazon, to Netflix, you know, with the invasion of the body snatchers, with the greatest economic decline in our lifetime, we got data, we got observation points, we got to see businesses which remained not only robust and intact but expanded, and so you kind of put the two together. You go, wow, we just had like the biggest nominal GDP contraction kind of almost ever. We've just had the biggest explosion in adult unemployment ever. And these businesses' profits went up. They are riskless. And therefore, there's kind of no intellectual ceiling on the valuation that I can pay for them or justify paying for them today. And by extension, that took treasuries to 0% yield. So I fear I've meandered away from your question, but I like the government saying, hey, we got it, you know, our pecker's up, kind of doesn't matter because that form of spending is one-off, whereas we're talking, you know, Raoul's out there with his exponential age. The power of private sector money printing is that it's exponential, that it draws in the fractional reserve system, that I go, I take a loan, I create commerce, I succeed, you know, and then there's a whole kind of universe around me that starts copying me, and then banks are lending, and off we go. That is not initiated by bureaucrats in Washington, and that's not a value judgment against them. It's just not the nature, again, of risk and culture and social soft factors.
Okay. I'm all right. Let's say I'm buying this. Your bullishness then on commodities, usually that has a lot to do with inflation expectations, but yours apparently does not. And I know you're saying, well, you thought we had the third wave, you know, after the financial crisis, but you think we're on the cusp of a third wave of, you know, commodities kind of outperforming here, correct?
Yes.
So, but it doesn't have to do with inflation though.
Well, it actually, central to it again is a social mood. So it's a social mood, which I'll describe.
You're so moody, Hugh.
Tell me about it. I'm so PMT. I mean, you think I'm joking? I'm not. But anyway, creating a change in relative prices. Now, whether those higher relative prices, the higher relative prices of commodities, whether they act as a catalyst for more widespread inflation, we will see. For the present, I don't need it to persist to make money. I need it to persist to make money over a longer arc of time, but in the here and now, I don't need it. So the social mood, again, it's social mood, is dominated by ESG, environmental social governance. And ESG is itself kind of delineated by carbon emissions, limiting, abolishing carbon emissions. All of that, I believe, is a function of a society which is rich. You know, the people who invest in YouTube fitness videos and personal trainers and God knows what are rich people. Like, life's great when you're rich. You just want more of it. You want it. You're like, you know, I've got to be Peter Pan. I've got to stay young. I love this life, you know, and that's, and so they're the, and so rich, of course, rich economies are the first ones to embrace staying alive. And there's this existential threat from what we're doing to what we're doing to the planet. And we've seen that in terms of flows of equity flows are like by a huge factor dominated by this phenomenon. So again, it's social mood. I would say to you that we had a change in social mood in the 1930s, which, and there's a bit of it that there's a shadow of it today, which of course is the revulsion of credit, the revulsion of bankers. Back in the 30s, social mood dictated that we had to kind of take this kind of nuclear arsenal away from the banks. We split them up in terms of their connection with the stock market. And we said to them, no more master of the universe, no more bonuses. We just want you to be boring book clerks. And for 40 years, society's demand was granted up until the early 1970s. And it passed simply because the most vociferous exponents of that that mood died. So today I would liken ESG and this, I mean, it is a profoundly deep rooted phenomenon, especially in the young today, that things have to be done. And things are being done. So stock markets or capital markets, it's all about sex at the end of the day. It's all about you procreating. It's about the selfish gene. And what markets do is they like things. They really like them. They fall into love with them. And these things go up. You get reflexivity, which comes in and accentuates it. But the market's saying, we love this so much. We want you to do more and more. Like, go and buy things. Go and, you know, go and spend lots of money. Open things. Just make yourself more plentiful because we love you. We just can't get enough of you. And, of course, then you get the opposite. You know, typically, industries, they do that. We've seen this. You see 20-year cycles in semiconductors. You know, a fab site can be, heavens, back in my day, it was $1 billion. It must be $2 billion. You're going to kind of think long and hard before you commit to that. You're going to think long and hard where you put it. And you've got this crazy stock market going, do it. And then when you come through, then the market's, oh, too late. And then they hate you for 10. So as hedge fund speculating guys, we get to understand cycles like that. And so bringing it back to the present, mining is deemed to be, it's like, we don't want you having any more babies. You know, we don't want you procreating. We want you to disappear. I think we saw the International Energy Association saying by 2050, like no more mining projects. I mean, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but you know, saying we want you to die. You know, if you're not investing like that, you're not going to have a future. You're going to move from being a perpetuity. You know, stocks are deity. Stocks, the underlying preposterous assumption behind any stock in the stock market today is that it's a godlike creature that will persist in infinity. And what ESG is saying, we are taking that deity away from you and you are going to expire. So today, let's look at the huge mining global, largely European headquartered mining stocks, BHP Billiton, Rio Tinto, and then you've got the kind of Brazilian one, Vale. They're like, we hear you. You know, so normally the signal is, you know, amour, amour, I'm in love with you and I'm bidding your price up. So I'm giving you the green light. Go, go and explore. Go and be brave. Go and find me more of this stuff. And the miner's like, ain't doing it, baby. You know, I kind of, two things. I listened to you crazy guys between 2009 and 2011 when you took gold from $600 to $1,800 and everything else. And you told me, you know, I listened to you and, you know, BHP spent $20 billion in CapEx in 2012. And that was just one company. They all did. It was all poorly timed. And the sector lost 75% of its value because of the value destruction. So 8-9 years later, like, I ain't doing that. Plus, I've got ESG guys on my board, my biggest shareholders. Every damn question I've got to answer is, you know, they're trying to kind of justify our existence. So you know what? Instead, Billiton is going to give you $20 billion in cash. Look, here's the money back. We're not procreating. You go and procreate with windmills and solar panels. Okay. So the money which would create a supply response to this, the last year's price increases, is not going to happen, which is to say that the price increases are going to be accentuated until something gives. And they ain't going to build it. If they ain't going to build it, there's going to be shortages. Now, for the wider economy, you've got to remember, commodities are typically things that you need. You know, you got to fill your car up with gas. And if the price doubles or triples, then, you know, maybe you don't go to the cinema. Maybe you don't eat out as much. Maybe you kind of, you know, there's discretionary and non-discretionary. So I'm not sure where the leap is. The leap is when you have that phenomenon of higher prices which continue. And again, remember, you've got a central bank which at least for a year or so is just going to sit there and going to, as best as it can, do nothing. I just think you've got free road to, you know, to have fun in these stocks. And not just specifically those mining stocks. There's a profound change going on. You know, those who said that the stock market is a bubble and that it's dangerously overvalued, I again would contend and would go against that. I think that's kind of lazy thinking. What is remarkable when you survey the landscape of large cap equities is how many stocks that you can find trading at the same nominal price as they were at the end of the 1980s. So in a bubble, some Whoa. Of the largest, yeah, I mean, like, you know, and A, it's a function of ESG. Yeah, like, I procrastinated. I was going to say tobacco stocks, so damn cheap. But, you know, it's like, oh my God, you can't say that. You can't invest in that. Social mood can provide opportunities. But, you know, Exxon, I mean, heavens, you know, I can take you through so many sectors. So what happened was 10-year treasury risk-free securities kind of repriced to zero. And therefore, if you can find commercial activities that seem to have almost no commercial risk, then they become infinite. So, you know, Apple becomes the first $1 trillion asset. And then it becomes $3 trillion in today's world. I call trillions apples, you know. So Apple today is about 2.25 apples, you know. And we've got about 5 or 6 stocks which all trade with this Apple or trillion vernacular. They command and distort the valuation metrics of the indices. But behind that, the run-of-the-mill companies that had commercial risk, they've been sold into almost extinction. And The market is getting that now. And maybe that's back to your point that it, the policy was set too tight after 2008 for various reasons. And for sure, the most obvious tightness was in the public sector, right? You know, even today, yesterday I read about Macron, President Macron in France. I mean, he should lose with social mood. The election is next year, and he's going to be up against Marie Le Pen, and she's many things. She's populist, but she comes with a kind of, you know, a kind of dirty background and kind of, you know, a kind of fascist like father, and they've been trying to leave that behind. But she's populist, and France should be the sovereign should be spending like America, and it ain't. And Macron's in trouble. So, but anyway, that the US taking the lead as usual. So we definitely have policy today versus policy after 2008. There is a pivot that policy is getting less rigid. And that would seem to be a boon for businesses with commercial risk. And I've never found so many instances of stocks I want to buy. I want to buy GM. I want to buy Ford. I want to buy US Steel. I mean, I'm blushing, you know. I want to buy Canadian oil sands. I want to buy coal companies. I want to buy Credit Suisse. I want to buy Rolls Royce. I want to buy stocks that prices that prevailed 30 years ago. Bring it on.
Yeah, you just, all those names you threw out, I feel like you just threw me into the Wayback Machine. That's actually really cool. No one I've interviewed has said that. That's great. We've been talking for quite a while, and I've loved it. I wish I could just pour myself another cup of coffee and do this for another 45 minutes. But I have a final question that I ask all my guests, and I've been actually dying to get to it with you because I can't imagine what the answer would be. I can often guess the answer, but with you, no idea. And the final question I ask every guest on this show is, if you could leave our listener with just one thought today, and you may have already done so, that's cool if you did, but if you could leave our listener with just a single thought in mind today, what would it be?
Oh, man. I really dislike experts like accountants and lawyers because when you ask them a really tough question, they change the question to something that they can answer. And I'm going to do that. I'm going to leave you with my typical kind of scattergun. I want to leave you with the thought, in the enterprise of risk-taking, never be fearful of being wrong. If you're fearful of being wrong, you're approaching it the wrong way. Yeah? So, that gave me longevity. I secured 15 years of tenure as a hedge fund manager. Some blasted filthy person went onto the Wikipedia page and put 8 words of prejudice on my page saying, he closed the fund down after, you know, I don't know, 6 years of mediocre returns. Who said they were mediocre? You know, I was out there providing convex returns in the event of a volatility eruption, which never came forward, came to happen. Indeed, from 2013, I said to my clients, take the money because this is a dumb endeavor. I just can't foresee that happening. And then one great fear that I have, and obviously great fears, I hope it doesn't come to pass, but I fear something I fear the further aggravation of the social mood in America. As an economy, I'm not there. I'm looking from the outside in. And so, you know, that has good and bad points. But it feels to me like an outsider that America just feels more fractional and more divided than at any point. And it brings back how people described the German Republic after the First World War, a very fractious society with North hating South, with Catholics against Protestants, you name it, you know. And the great fear that we have to be on the lookout for is some, and it tortures me to say this, but some heinous intervention where someone is killed owing to the social mood. In Germany, it's often underlooked that there was a candidate for president that could have brought the nation together. He seemed to be the less toxic. He was charming, he was a speaker, and he was assassinated. And that was the dawn of chaos. Like, once you start killing politicians of that stature, all bets are off. There's no smart contract to protect you. We saw the same thing, I want to say, in about 1935. They had the Japanese had a kind of John Maynard Keynes character, spent a lot, ran up big budget deficits, and that was a boom for the military complex, and they militarized, and we all know what happened. But from about 1935, he kind of, job was done, and he wanted to rein back the liquidity. And of course, that was in contravention to what the military was planning in the years ahead. They assassinated the guy. They basically lined him up against the wall, and boom. He now features, but he's the only central bank governor, certainly in Japan, to feature on a banknote, I think the 50 yen banknote. God forbid, and last year, obviously we saw something begin there with death. We got to hope that stays out of the kind of upper echelons of the political system, because a death assassination would be the dawn of chaos. And then I think we would be looking at some hideous outcomes. But for the time being, and that's the probability of that, thankfully, I think is still remarkably low. And I think the probability of making money from all of these, from making money against this kind of crazy cult called ESG, which has left some like unbelievably cash generative businesses trading at unbelievably highly attractive valuations. That's the zeitgeist just now. So there you go.
So in some ways, one of the best answers I've ever gotten, but in one way, of course, the worst, because it was like five things instead of one. But
it was a cheat.
It was a cheat. But it was a good cheat, Hugh. A very good one. Thank you. And listen, thanks a lot. I will definitely be inviting you back onto the show. So just, prepare for that email in 6 or 8 months or so.
Love it. Love it. Thank you very much.
All right, Hugh. Enjoy the sunshine. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Take care, guys. Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye-bye. Wow, is all I can say. That was certainly one of our longest interviews. And I knew it would be, because I know once Hugh gets going, it's hard to stop him, and I don't want to stop him. I could do this for another hour, I feel like. But I hope you realize that you just got an incredible education in what you might call like global macro investing. That's what Hugh is. If you've heard that global macro is dead, I mean, he just threw out five or six names. And he also mentioned, the other day I heard him mention a steel company too, and he mentioned steel. He said U.S. Steel. And he mentioned ThyssenKrupp, a German steel company. So, I mean, that was loaded with names and loaded with viewpoints that we will just never hear anywhere else. That view on ESG as being a reason to buy mining stocks, I don't know if that's a reason. I don't know if you're going to hear that elsewhere. It was great. Loved it. All right, before the mailbag, I wanted to quickly tell you about our show next week, when I will interview Wall Street legend Mark Chaykin. Mark hosted a webinar Tuesday night viewed by over 30,000 investors. He reveals a small cap stock that he thinks could rise over 500%. He will also reveal his big prediction for post-pandemic America and where to put your money immediately. His service reviews tomorrow's stock ratings on Wall Street to see which of 4,000 stocks could realistically rise 100% or more. This is a must-attend event that can be replayed by going to 2021prediction.com. And be sure to tune in next week for the interview. That's 2021prediction.com. In the mailbag each week, you and I have an honest conversation about investing or whatever is on your mind. Just send your questions, comments, and politely worded criticisms, please, to feedback@investorhour.com. I read as many emails as time allows, and I respond to as many as possible. You can also call us at the listener feedback line. Please do. If you call us and it's good, I'll put you on the air. You get to hear your voice on the show. 800-381-2357, 800-381-2357. Tell me what's on your mind and get on the show. How cool would that be? First question this week is from Mike B. He's a Paid Up Alliance member. And he says, Dan, I appreciate your approach to investing and have shared similar thoughts on diversifying into other non-equity assets, such as precious metals, collectibles, etc. I do have a whole life insurance policy that I've had for about 13 years and has a decent amount of cash value. Do you consider the cash value of that policy to be part of your plenty of cash in your asset allocation? I can always take out some of that to invest in the market if it has a large correction or I need it for emergency funds, etc. Thank you, Mike B. Mike, you know, that is such a personal thing, but all I would say for me, if I were in that position, I would view that cash as absolute last resort, you know, down to my last penny, no other resources. That's the way I would view it. How you view it is up to you. But it's a good question. I personally would not think of it. When I say make sure you're holding plenty of cash, I mean liquid cash in your account ready to pull the trigger. Good question, though. Our second and only other question this week comes from Ludovic H., who writes in quite a bit. And keep it coming, Ludovic. I love your stuff, man. And he says simply, what do you think about the claim from Harry Dent that gold will go down when the crisis and collapse happen? So I don't really keep up with Harry Dent's predictions. I know he's always making a big prediction of some kind. But all I will say about your question is that we've learned that it makes sense to assume that if we get a really horrendous bear market or market crash or financial crisis, that gold drops in price too. Everybody seems to want cash more than they want anything else. And so, you know, you get the price of gold falling. And it did that in the financial crisis, and it did it also, you know, in the COVID crisis. So I think, you know, it's a logical expectation. People just, when they initially panic, they just want gold. And it was kind of a head fake in 2008, because then we got this thing, you know, this idea that the Fed was going to unleash inflation, which never really materialized. And so gold took off again, made new highs, and then went into a really steep bear market through 2015, 2016. So yeah. Your question makes sense. I think Dent is right about that much, at least. I won't say anything else about what he predicts, but I think he's right about that, at least temporarily, right? You never know how the crisis is going to play out or precisely what kind of a crisis we could be looking at. Maybe it's one in which people really start to worry about the value of the US dollar, which they never seem too terribly worried about for very long in the last, you know, 10, 15 years. But it's a good question, though. Thank you for that. That's another mailbag. That's another episode of the Stansberry Investor Hour. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. We provide a transcript for every episode, but sometimes it takes a while to get it done. Just go to www.investorhour.com, click on the episode you want, and scroll all the way down and click on the word transcript. If you like this episode, send somebody a link. Just tell them to check it out on their podcast app or at investorhour.com so we can help the show grow. Do me a favor too, subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're there, help us grow with a rate and a review. You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Our handle is @InvestorHour. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @Investor_Hour. If you want me to interview somebody, tell me about it. Drop me a note at feedback@InvestorHour.com or call the listener feedback line and get your voice on the show. 800-381-2357. Tell me what's on your mind. Till next week, I'm Dan Ferris. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Stansberry Investor Hour. To access today's notes and receive notice of upcoming episodes, go to investorhour.com and enter your email. Have a question for Dan? Send him an email, feedback@investorhour.com. This broadcast is for entertainment purposes only and should not be considered personalized investment advice. Trading stocks and all other financial instruments involves risk. You should not make any investment decision based solely on what you hear. Stansberry Investor Hour is produced by Stansberry Research and is copyrighted by the Stansberry Radio Network.